I'm Alex Michelson. Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. This week, the issue is coronavirus, of course. It continues to grow, and we're talking to one of the leaders for the federal response, Dr. Deborah Birx, the leader of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, the coordinator, joins us. Plus, we talk with Daryl Issa, who used to be one of the biggest names in Congress. Then he lost his election in 2018. Now he just won his election in 2020. He's going back to Congress. And a little later, we'll talk with Tom Steyer, who ran Governor Newsom's task force for economic recovery in California. But let's begin with Dr. Birx, who chose to do our interview wearing a mask the entire time to send a signal to everybody that it's important to wear masks. We talked to her as cases are growing, California instituting a partial curfew this week. So lots to talk about. Here's Dr. Birx.
Dr. Birx, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Glad to be with you.
Let's begin with the good news, right? Because we all can use some good news these days. Let's talk about the vaccines. This week, major progress. Pfizer applying for emergency use authorization from the FDA. Major progress when it comes to the Moderna vaccine. Take us behind the scenes on what's going on there right now and what we can expect next.
Great. Well, let me just start by thanking the Americans, over 70,000 of them, that stood up and agreed to be on these trials. And because of them and because of their sacrifice, we now know that two vaccines have really extraordinary effectiveness and so now and safety. And so we have two additional, in addition to the Moderna and the Pfizer, there's Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca in trial now. So this is very encouraging to every American, and that's why we're asking every American, and particularly every Californian in this moment, you know what to do. You did it in the summer, and we need you to do it again, and we need you to protect one another.
Yeah, I noticed that you are choosing to wear a mask for this interview, even though you are, I presume, 6 feet apart from people. Why that decision? What are you trying to say?
You know, I want to make sure that every American that knows you can work in these masks, you can socially interact in masks, you can be physically distanced and still socially engaged. We've given everyone the ability to really be together with masks on, and that's what we need to do going into the holiday season. I know it's a personal sacrifice for everyone to really limit their gatherings at this time.
So let's talk about what's happening in California. This week, the big news is the governor is putting in what he calls a limited stay-at-home order, basically a curfew from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. for restaurants, bars, other non-essential businesses. From a scientific perspective, does this make sense? Because other states, other countries have done curfews, and does the science bear that out?
Well, you know, I don't ever second guess the governor. I've been to 42 states now talking to governors and mayors, and it's really important. Governors know their unique situations in their states. I'm always happy to provide advice on what we're seeing, but we're seeing significant spread throughout California, and something needs to be done now. Now, we know across in the summer, many of the states were able to control this virus by doing a mask mandate, limiting indoor dining, closing bars, restricting gyms, and really talking to their communities about really stopping gatherings and personal social gatherings in individual households. And that stopped the spread of this virus. We can do that again, and we know that works.
But have you seen science that suggests that a curfew makes a big difference?
You know, in Miami County and Miami City, they had to do that because they had continued to have spread despite closing the bars and closing indoor dining. But then they realized that where that spread was happening was in personal gatherings, households and communities and families getting together to really be together, and they weren't taking precautions. So they had their mask off, and that was really the source of significant community spread. And so it's really important, independent of whether you have a curfew or not have a curfew, we know what the drivers of these infections are, and it does take each individual to decide that their family is special to them and their friends are special to them.
Let's talk sort of big picture. What have we learned since the beginning of this? LA County, the biggest county in California, is now talking about going back to a safer at home model if we see cases average over 4,500 a day for 5 days as an average. One day this week, cases were at 5,300 cases in just one day. Based off of everything that we have learned so far, does that sort of mass shutdown of a safer at home still make sense? Is that still necessary, or is there maybe a more targeted approach based off of what we've learned so far?
Well, we learned across the South, again, that approach of a very targeted approach works, but it requires everyone buying into that. We can make public spaces safer. Governors and mayors can do that, but they can't make your private space safer. And that's really on all of us to mask, physically distance. And if we're going to be with others, make it sure it's outside with masks on, and that every time you go inside with people who are not part of your immediate household, you could be creating a viral spreading event that will affect your community and the economics of your community.
Let's talk for a moment about the issue of schools, because we have seen businesses opened, but schools closed through much of California and through much of the country. Now we know everything that we know. Was that a wise priority?
What we've learned through the fall in the colleges, the universities, and the K-12 schools that opened, that the in-physical classrooms with masks on was a safe environment. Colleges did not see spread in the classroom. And colleges that continued to test for what we call that asymptomatic silent spread vastly reduced the amount of community spread among the community of college students.
So what you're saying right now, I mean, because college students are way more at risk in terms of the science of this than much younger kids, what you're saying is, why can't we just open up the schools? Why can't we open up elementary schools, middle schools, high schools, based off of what you just said?
Well, a lot of states did.
Right.
And I want to tell you, a lot of universities did. And I want to really applaud those university presidents because they took a risk. But what they said was they believed that the students would follow the guidelines. And what we learned is 18 to 22-year-olds followed the guidelines. They masked on campus. I've been to over 30 campuses. I've seen these campuses. Students used masks. They really totally recreated their facilities so that people could be physically distanced in the classroom. They protected their faculty and their staff. And you know what? They made it to today. And many of them are going home now, having been tested on the university campus, having been taking extra precautions to protect their parents when they return home. So if our college students can be that responsible, you would think as the rest of America, we could learn from them and be as responsible in our behaviors.
The information that you're talking about is literally life or death. And I'm curious if you have been in communication with the Biden-Harris transition team about the information that you're talking about. If they have been in communication with you about potentially staying on in that administration and whether you would want to.
I haven't had that opportunity yet, but as you know, someone who's been in government for 40 years through 6 or 7 different presidents in their transition and supporting who's ever president at the time with your best judgment, your best determination, your best work. And that's how I've lived my life. I stand available to, if they think I am useful in the transition or they think I'm useful in the future. I have always, that's been my work ethic from the beginning in service and in service of this country. And it's been a wonderful life of work.
But isn't that kind of surprising that you're the coordinator for the White House on this issue and you have not been in communication with the Biden-Harris transition team on the biggest issue of the day?
Well, I think, you know, there's very strict rules around transition and how they occur. And having been through multiple of those transitions, I understand why we have to wait for that moment in time when transition can occur. I will tell them, and they should be reassured, we are ready. We are transparent, as we have been with the governors, We've sent them a report every single Monday. It's a detailed report at the data with data visualizations. Data is helpful when it leads to action.
Right.
And we all need to act on the data we have now.
And just to wrap things up, any final word for the people of California right now as this thing continues to spread?
So the people of California, I know you well. My brother was at Lawrence Livermore Labs and then lived in Oakley, California, which was a privilege to visit outside of the Delta. And I just want to say to each and every one of you, particularly the moms out there, I know you want to see your friends and family. I know you want to get together, but now is the moment to be extra vigilant. Let's get everyone vaccinated. Let's control this virus. And let's have a future together. And we make these personal sacrifices over these next few weeks so that we have a lifetime together. And that's what I would like every Californian to do.
Well, Dr. Birx, happy Thanksgiving to you and your family early as well as this sort of strange year continues. Thank you for your service to our country and thank you for taking time to talk to us on such a busy and important week.
Thank you. Take care, every Californian.
All right. Our thanks to Dr. Birx. Up next, former and future Republican Congressman Daryl Issa is with us. And a reminder as we go to break to log on to our website, theissueisshow.com.
Our thanks to Dr. Birx. Now to Daryl Issa, the Republican from San Diego, one of the wealthiest people in Congress. He became the chair of the Oversight Committee during the Obama administration, got a lot of national attention for that, ran statewide in California. Then he lost in 2018 when his district became purple. Now in 2020, he's moved to a different district, the one once held by Duncan Hunter, a much more Republican district, and he won that district. And so he's now headed back to Congress. So here's our conversation with Daryl Issa.
Congressman-elect, welcome to The Issue Is.
Well, thank you. It's the good news is you're supposed to have the term congressman for life, but the hyphenation gets a little old, so I'll be happy when we drop the elect and former.
Yeah, I don't quite know what to call you, so we'll just go. Let's start by talking about some of the electoral success for Republicans in California, because you were in a pretty reliably Republican district that you won, but several of the purple districts, the real swing districts, are being won by Republicans in California and being won in a year where Joe Biden looks like he's going to beat Donald Trump in this state by about 30 points. What's going on here? What do you think is the message that voters are sending?
Well, I think it's a return to the center, having seen each of those incumbents that were defeated here in California, having voted to impeach the president on a pretty frivolous claim when people look at it after the fact. So that's a factor. If each of these districts were in 2018, an example where the combination of ballot harvesting and perhaps running against President Trump at that time allowed for the defeat of a number of members, including, you know, the seat that I just won came within 3 points of being defeated. So the bounce back with my winning by 8 and several of these others, up to 4 other seats returning, is really a return to the normal. I don't want to claim some sort of a resurgence of Republican dominance in California. This is no longer the state that would call Reagan quite the same home, but it is an example where people went too far and the pendulum is now swinging back to closer to its norm.
Well, speaking of Reagan and speaking of the guy behind you, Abraham Lincoln, President Trump tweeted about you this week. Let's put this up on the screen. It says, "Thank you, Daryl Issa." And it is when you said that the president is on par with Abraham Lincoln and Ronald Reagan in terms of his value add to the Republican Party. Can you expand on what you mean by that?
Absolutely. You know, when Reagan and to a great extent Goldwater came into the party of Lincoln, they didn't come in, if you will, to a party in which the South, if you will, the conservative Democrats voted with us. And Reagan changed that and added a considerable amount of a voting bloc that has made us a majority party, you know, most at least half the time since then. Donald Trump came in, and in my hometown, my birthplace of Cleveland, Ohio, suddenly blue-collar union workers are seeing the Republican Party as the party that they should belong to. So in the same way, it's additive. President Trump has added a whole group of voters who believe that the Republican Party can and do care for them, particularly when it comes to fairness in foreign trade, not letting their jobs be traded to the lowest common denominator. And so I think this is a permanent opportunity, just as the Reagan coalition is still with us and the Lincoln coalition to a certain extent is still with us. We want to make sure that this group of people who believe, as they should, that Republicans are going to fight for their jobs and they're not going to sell them out to foreign lower cost. I think that's important, and I think it can be a permanent change to our party.
Do you think he also may have added to the Democratic Party, though? We see states like Georgia, Arizona changing on the strength of African-American turnout, Mexican-American turnout, and that he may have emboldened the other side.
Well, there's no question at all that President Trump has assets that he's brought to the party, and there's the so-called Never Trumpers. So one of the challenges for Republicans is to bring back the suburban women that it's stated that he underperformed with. I will say that his African-American vote, his Jewish vote, his Hispanic vote has far exceeded what the pundits would have said it was. You know, when he fought for a wall and fought for a better trade relationship, in his first race, there was a real question about whether the Hispanics should vote for him. But after they saw the lowest level of unemployment in their lives and real opportunities, he's done better, and he can still, you know, our party, if we continue that direction, can do better too.
Who do you think won the election, Joe Biden or Donald Trump?
Well, you know, this is one of those situations that I came into Congress in 2000 when 537 votes in the first count were the difference between one president and another. The courts made a decision based on facts, based on the law. And at the end of the day, George W. Bush was the president. And I was quite satisfied with that. My Democratic opponents continued to call him an appointed president for years. So now we're in a situation in which there are court challenges. And just as those 37 days in 2000, I believe people should allow the courts to do their job. The president and, for that matter, Vice President Biden have a right to be represented in front of judges under the law in each of those states and let the courts decide.
But the president has stated emphatically that there was voter fraud. He has said that the election was rigged and that it was unfair towards him. Have you seen any evidence that the election was rigged? Have you seen any evidence of mass voter fraud?
Well, you know, you use the term mass. So as soon as you use the term mass, that's an undefined number. So how about we do it this way?
Enough to change the outcome of the election. How about that?
How about this? We have in every election, in every state, in every county, different rules. There's no common denominator. In one state, they believe that you should have to show ID to vote. In California, they'll force you to put the ID away. They won't look at it, either to register you or for you to vote. So the lack of common rules give people around the country a reason to be concerned. No question at all, the pandemic was, for better or worse, a factor. The idea that people were forced to stand too far away to verify whether or not ballots were being honestly duplicated when they were dealing with a spoiled ballot. All of these things give a fair question of voter confidence. On one hand, I want to let the courts make decisions about actual fraud. You know, there are hundreds of affidavits sworn under penalty of perjury by people alleging various forms of fraud. That's for the court to decide. But for people like myself, going back to Congress with years of experience, this is an opportunity, just as we did in 2002, to do another round and hopefully a more successful round of adding to the confidence of the American people that the voting system will be common, predictable, and reliable. And so that's what I'm looking forward to doing. And I would hope that, well, the courts decide what happened in the past, Congress decides how to have people have confidence in the future.
Let's talk about some of the priorities of Congress for a moment. Obviously, issue number one right now is the coronavirus. So many of your constituents are hurting right now. What do you think should be Congress's approach when it comes to coronavirus aid? there's a lot of folks that wish the Congress would act right now, but it appears we may have to wait until you take over in January.
Well, if Nancy Pelosi would bring a bill to the floor to allow the $133 billion that's just sitting there from the last round to be used for PPP, which would only require an update of one line, the date of expiration, people could begin getting access to those funds immediately. It's a shame when monies are sitting there appropriated and a date limitation and an unwillingness to move that by the Speaker of the House is stopping it. So there are, you're right, there are some things that could be done right away. I think Congress has a bigger challenge going forward. This patchwork of county health officials, state governors who have very different views between, let's say, Florida and California and Texas, have given us a situation in which laws that we allowed to be enacted based on smallpox with a 30% morbidity are being used in something that runs about 0.2% death rate. That alone is one of the challenges. I'm not saying that precautions shouldn't be taken, that Congress shouldn't act to provide relief and particularly support for things that would help protect the public. But I'm also very acutely aware that we reacted based on the unknown. And now that we know what we know, we're still reacting in a way that I think and the governor and I might disagree, is overreacting. And that's a challenge that I think Congress is going to face to make sure it doesn't happen again.
So now that we know what we know, how should we react?
You know, we should react to protect those who are at high risk. You know, among service members, active duty military personnel, for example, the mortality rate is about 10 per 100,000. That really is less than what you would lose in a couple of years of just training exercises. So I do believe that we have to value the risk fairly. And for example, military personnel, young and healthy, should likely continue to train at a historically normal level. And if we did so, that obviously makes us safer. Many of the same rules apply. When we look at children, they have almost no risk. When we look at the elderly, there's a greater risk. So I think defining that is important. You know, lastly, the public interest by definition is not to protect you from giving away your life in some reckless behavior. If it was, we wouldn't have marijuana clinics. We wouldn't have smoking still allowed. We wouldn't have drinking still allowed. So the public interest is that the hospitals not be over swamped in a way in which innocent people would not be given access to health care. And if we go back to that, the government helping make sure we have the resources, mm-hmm. and then those resources being protected from those excesses, that would change considerably what the governor's orders would be like. You know, lastly, I'm a libertarian, and I'm in the party of libertarians. What you tell somebody to do, as long as it's at their own risk, is in fact much more limited than the governor thinks it is. And I would disagree with some of his views about what a family can do in their own home over Thanksgiving.
Right. Although some of the Libertarian Party members might say that you're not in the party of libertarians, but that's a whole other thing. Let's talk for a moment about the governor. This week, Fox 11 Los Angeles exclusively obtained photos of Governor Newsom's dinner at the French Laundry with several high-profile lobbyists. I talked with somebody who took this picture this week. What is your reaction to seeing these images and hearing about this event?
Well, I think I'm going to surprise you a little bit. You know, when the governor, when he was lieutenant governor, and I got to know each other pretty well. I've read his book. He's read my book. Look, he made a mistake. He's apologized. Certainly, it seems pretty hypocritical when you look at this. And I think this is one of those gotcha moments that shows that maybe do as I say, not as I do, means that you shouldn't have to do what he says. And I think that's the credibility question that he's now dealing with. But I also think that this is one of those challenges where all the governors are trying to do what appears to be the right thing, and it's part of the reason we often end up with excesses. So this is an opportunity that I hope the governor will take to maybe measure twice and cut once on his orders going forward. I don't want to jump on what he's already apologized for. We're all human and there are mistakes. So that doesn't mean that we're going to be best buddies, but it does mean that I know exactly how he feels when that sort of thing happens. I will say one thing, though. The lobbyists for the hospital industry being there without a mask in that does beg the question for what are they lobbying for? And is that lobbyist out of line? And, the unnamed lobbyist sometimes is the person we should look at.
I think the headline of this interview is a Newsom ISIP romance. that's what we're saying.
No, it's not a romance, but right. I will say this. The governor is a reality of California politics. And because of the voters, I'm a reality. So is Juan Vargas and Scott Peters in San Diego. As elected officials, now that the election is over, we have an obligation to do our job. Partisan politics is certainly a factor, but it shouldn't be the determinant of us working together. Yeah. And it hasn't been for me in the past, and I won't let it be in the future.
That is literally the purpose of this show, to have a civil discourse with people on both sides. And part of that, we like to get to know people a little bit. We play a game called Personal Issues to have a little bit of fun and get to know you. This is the first time that you've been on this show. So what we do is we put 30 seconds up on a clock, and we ask you some questions. So here we go. You ready? What's your favorite movie?
Godfather.
Favorite meal to cook?
Steaks.
Favorite type of music?
I'm a folk music guy a lot more than people think.
Who's your favorite liberal?
It's probably going to be the president.
Favorite
now,
way to relax?
My favorite way to relax is quite frankly skiing. I love it.
And who's your role model?
Well, I'm going to have to say Ronald Reagan. If you hadn't asked for liberal, by the way, General Wesley Clark is my favorite Democrat. I served with him in the military, but I can't call him a liberal. He's a Democrat, but he's not really a liberal.
And when you say favorite liberal has to be the president, are you referring to, who are you referring to? Donald Trump?
No. Look, if Joe Biden becomes the president, he will be a person that we have an obligation to work with, push back at times. But there's an awful lot of legislation that needs to be done, including election reform, transparency in government. There's a lot of those things. And probably the one that's hardest is, who's your favorite liberal? Again, my friend General Wesley Clark is my favorite Democrat. But, the word liberal kind of throws that in a little aside. I will say that Juan Vargas and I are the closest in Congress to each other, have traveled together, and most people would say he's a liberal, but he's also my friend.
Our thanks to Daryl Issa. Now to Tom Steyer, who, of course, ran for president, billionaire, one of the biggest activists in Democratic politics in California, big climate change activist, big activist for impeachment. Earlier this year in April, Governor Newsom asked him to run, along with his chief of staff, Ann O'Leary, the California Economic Recovery Task Force, bringing together about 100 different business leaders from around the state to look at the issue of how to bring California jobs back. So here's Tom Steyer.
Based upon his advocacy, based upon his leadership, Tom Steyer.
Thank you, Mr. Governor.
Former presidential candidate Tom Steyer helped coordinate more than 100 California business leaders, including Apple CEO Tim Cook and real estate magnate Rick Caruso, in offering suggestions to Governor Gavin Newsom to ease the pain of businesses struggling during the pandemic.
Everybody did it out of the goodness of their hearts for each other, and they put aside all their differences. That's how it's supposed to work when you're in a crisis.
Their bottom line suggestion?
To have a sustained and positive recovery, we need to put health first. We need to have the virus under control.
The task force promoting a hashtag Shop Safe, Shop Local campaign online and a California Rebuilding Fund to help small businesses survive.
I have heard those small business owners come and cry, and my heart completely goes out to them. We are all in this together, and they have done nothing wrong.
I asked about the timing of shutting down the task force now, right as the governor is restricting more businesses with curfews and closures.
It is coincidental that we're putting out our report and, you know, completing these proposals at a time of a spike in the pandemic.
As for Steyer's future, could he soon be joining the administration of his primary rivals, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris?
I think it's absolutely critical for them to succeed as an administration, and I'll do anything I can to help that.
That sounds like a maybe to me. Our thanks to Tom Steyer as we go to break.
Our thanks to Tom Steyer, to Daryl Issa, to Dr. Deborah Birx, and to you for listening on another newsy week when it comes to coronavirus. Next week, we take a bit of a break from the news of the week. We're going to have a special conversation with Maria Shriver and her son Patrick Schwarzenegger on Thanksgiving week about gratitude and service and faith and family. I'm really looking forward to that, and I'm really looking forward to a bit of a break. But thank you for listening this week, and we hope that you'll share this out, tell other people about it, and send me a message in social media, at Alex Michelson. That's Alex with an E. We'll see you next time on The Issue Is.